The secondaries market came under the spotlight in new regulation passed by the US Securities and Exchange Commission last year, a somewhat unusual move given the size of the sub-asset class compared with the overall sprawling private markets landscape. Within the private fund advisor rules under the Investment Advisors Act of 1940, which were voted through in the second half of last year, GPs either based in the US or with US investors must obtain a fairness opinion or a valuation opinion from a third party in continuation fund transactions. That followed the requirement for registered private equity fund sponsors months prior. Under the new rules, managers will have 60 days from the end of each quarter to report GP-led continuation fund transactions, the removal of a general partner, investor-led liquidations, or other termination events under Form PF rules. This is not the first time the SEC has run the rule over secondaries activity. Rather, this is the result of its long-term focus on the market. In 2018, New York-headquartered lower mid-market-focused firm VSS and its head Jeffrey Stevenson settled with the SEC over alleged lack of disclosure of rising valuations on assets Stevenson purchased in a secondaries transaction out of one of the firm's older funds. The SEC censured VSS and Stevenson, and the firm agreed to pay a civil penalty totaling $200,000. The firm and Stevenson did not admit or deny the findings. Last year, California-based American Infrastructure Funds also settled with the SEC, agreeing to pay more than $1.6 million relating to charges that it inappropriately accelerated a monitoring fee, executed a conflicted GP-led transaction, and improperly allocated expenses between the manager and various funds, which governance, risk, and regulatory services provider Iron Road Partners detailed in an analyst note. I'm Madeline Farman, a senior reporter with Secondaries Investor. In this episode of the Decade of Secondaries Investing mini-series, I sat down with Iron Road Partners managing partner and founder Igor Rosenblatt and Ropes & Gray's chair of its Alternative Asset Opportunities Group, Isabel Desha, to discuss the build-up to the SEC's decision to hone in on the secondaries market within its regulation and the implications this has for the various parties involved in GP-led secondaries transactions. 10 years ago, Rosenblatt was the private equity expert in the Division of Enforcement of the SEC. He was also working on starting the private funds unit in the Division of Exams at the regulator.
2014 was also one of those, I think, transitional years in both private equity and secondaries, because 2014, the SEC brought its first large private equity enforcement case against KKR. And started building expertise in the secondary markets and started looking very closely at the conflicts of interest that are present, or at least at that time were present in secondaries, especially secondaries that were coming off funds that were raised during the 2008 financial crisis and then were struggling to raise capital. So it turned out to be a pretty important year.
Over the course of a decade, the size of the secondaries market more than doubled in annual transaction volume. Ropes & Gray's Desha was a partner at the firm.
And still representing, candidly, many of the same secondary buyers whom we continue to represent today. And working, you know, on a very comparable mix of deals to what we have today, you know, spin-outs of asset managers and GP-led restructurings, portfolio purchases and the like.
The growth of the sub-asset class reflects the private markets industry as a whole, Desha explained.
The volume of transactions has just skyrocketed, in particular in recent years. And certainly thinking of the Ropes volume of secondaries, you know, and how that has grown, you know, over the past couple of years, you know, 40 billion to 72 to 110 to 100 and I think 45 to, you know, north of 155 billion. You know, what used to be more bespoke transactions that might be, you know, tailored to a comparatively small subset of asset managers and factual circumstances are now a broadly accepted exit path for fund sponsors. In tandem with sort of growing acceptance of GP-leds and secondaries in general, we've watched just the growth in the private funds industry as a whole. And that means that the sort of the opportunity set for potential transactions has multiplied.
Let's take the story back. Rosenblatt told me the traditional LP-led secondaries market really began to take shape in the aftermath of the dot-com boom and subsequent bust in the early 2000s.
The first instance of secondaries were funds that could not raise capital that began to start restructuring themselves and essentially creating difficult situations and forcing sales to third parties at prices that were perhaps below what the market would bear in exchange for those third parties providing more capital to those fund managers so that they could keep going. And because of that start, secondaries in, again, private equity fund interests really started to get a bad reputation in both the industry from an LP perspective, also from a GP perspective.
After the financial crisis, the SEC decided to bolster specific expertise, Rosenblatt told me. That really had to do with the Madoff investment scandal, which saw investor Bernie Madoff admit to perpetrating a massive Ponzi scheme.
And after that, that was the lesson learned by the SEC, and they started building expertise. They brought me in as the private equity expert. There were, at the time, again, 10 years ago in 2014, there were maybe 20 or 30 other experts in different parts of the financial markets.
Those in the SEC with secondaries expertise brought the notion with them that there are significant conflicts of interest in such transactions, Rosenblatt explained.
And indeed, right after the financial crisis, we saw similar situations in the secondary markets where fund managers who could not raise capital entered into some complicated and conflicted transactions with third parties to allow them to raise capital at the expense of investors that were already in their funds. It turns out that there's a regulatory tool to address that, and it has to do with disclosure. There are some at the SEC who might call behavior like that that maybe taken to an extreme could be fraudulent. And so that's when the SEC really started looking into the secondary markets in earnest.
Since 2008, private markets have become increasingly creative in using secondary sales for a variety of reasons, and the transaction type, as it's evolved, has gotten more and more complicated.
I think essentially at its root, most or all of these secondary transactions have some sort of conflicts of interest associated with them. Those conflicts of interest could be managed and disclosed. And I think many in the industry have gotten pretty sophisticated with getting those transactions right. But as you can see in the recent rulemaking, the SEC is still skeptical about the structure of some of these transactions and the conflicts associated with them.
It's important to note that the secondaries market has always been regulated by the SEC, Rosenblatt explained to me. The regulator at any time can examine a manager for conduct around a secondaries transaction, particularly a GP-led transaction, and if it chooses to, can commence an enforcement investigation. On the whole, though, it was pretty unusual for the regulator to include references to GP-led secondaries, a very small part of the financial market, in the two rules it recently passed.
For the SEC to spend time thinking about those issues is kind of a big tell. The rules themselves are very, very narrow, and they're not overly burdensome. And in particular, there are two rules. One rule is contained in a regulatory filing called Form PF, where managers who engage in GP-led transactions, again, they're defined very narrowly, have to report those transactions to the SEC quarterly. That is a big deal because prior to that, the SEC had no access to information about these types of transactions. And so it was very difficult for the SEC to identify and examine or commence investigations around them because they just simply didn't know where they were happening. The other rule is contained in the Private Fund Advisor Rule Package passed last August, and that rule requires for all GP-led secondary transactions to have fairness opinions issued by third parties, along with a little bit of additional disclosure about any conflicts of interest that those third parties might have.
The most notable element within the new rules is the requirement that advisors obtain and distribute to their investors a fairness or valuation opinion in connection with GP-led secondaries transactions, and that they also have to disclose any material business relationships they've had with those opinion providers within the past 2 years, Disha explained.
Now, that would be a regulatory requirement to have the fairness opinions, you know, which is new. That said, you know, if meaningful portion of GP-led transactions already involve fairness opinions. And so it's not necessarily going to reflect or force a massive change of practice. The core difference is that, you know, for that subset of transactions where sponsors have been proceeding without fairness opinions to date and have been getting their, you know, LPs comfortable with potential conflicts, you know, involved in the transaction in other manners, you know, if they need to get a fairness opinion, that they have to pay for the fairness opinion. And so that does add a bit of a cost drag. And, you know, that may, you know, mean that some transactions just aren't executable, you know, with the added cost drag and that they're no longer attractive.
So what is the SEC looking for when it's evaluating GP-led continuation vehicles? There are a few things that can go wrong that the SEC has been trained to look for and is starting to look closer at, Rosenblatt told me. The first one has to do with valuation.
And when we think of valuation, I think in a normal situation, the SEC typically worries that valuations are too high. In a GP-led restructuring situation, the SEC worries that the valuations are too low and that have been artificially depressed. That is because most LPs, or many LPs, make a decision about whether or not to transfer an asset based on the percentage of NAV that they are getting. And so the lower the value of your holding, the easier it is for you as the GP to tell your LP that you are transferring at 100% of NAV or even more than 100% of NAV. The SEC looks for a couple of red flags there. The biggest red flag is that an asset gets transferred from a fund into a continuation vehicle and then is quickly thereafter written up or increased in value.
Related to valuations, the SEC is looking into undisclosed material facts about the portfolio companies being transferred.
The biggest one is good news that hasn't been told to the selling investors, but has been told to the buying investors. For example, if a portfolio company is very close to selling or going public and the GP-led transaction transfers that into a continuation vehicle and then the company's promptly sold, that's a big red flag, as well as just performance metrics. So if a company has not been doing well, it transfers and suddenly it begins to really perform well. I think the SEC would be skeptical of that.
The regulator is also looking at the distribution of fees and expenses in these transactions.
Again, 10 years ago in 2014, this was actually somewhat of a big issue in the secondary space where the GP would collect economics that weren't disclosed. And in those situations, I think the SEC would try and, you know, act as quickly as possible. I think for the most part, from what I've seen, the legal community has done a good job of disclosing the split of economics, which I think in a GP-led situation could be complicated and could really benefit the people rolling as opposed to the people who choose to stay in the fund.
A really difficult issue for the SEC to get its hands around, but important for it nonetheless, has to do with the notification and election process. The regulator knows there are issues with this going on in the market.
So I think many LPs complain that they don't have enough time to evaluate some of these secondary transactions, but also some of the disclosures are written in a confusing way. There are sometimes material facts that are really exigent that, you know, on this podcast, I couldn't predict what they might be that aren't disclosed. And the SEC looks for that if it could find it. If SEC examiners could find those issues, I think they would pursue those.
The SEC also recognizes that the GP-led market, at least from a conflict of interest perspective, is cyclical. In downturn markets,
there are a lot of managers who can't raise additional capital who design GP-led transactions to either get their fees restarted in some way or to entice new investors into their funds just so they could keep going. And coming off of those difficult markets, the SEC knows to look for that kind of conflict of interest. GPs tend to use these GP-led transactions as almost a way to deploy capital in a difficult market environment that also has a conflict of interest associated with it, because a lot of the transactions that get involved in a GP-led situation may have fetched a better price out in the marketplace, and we just never know because there's often not a non-GP-led auction in those situations. And so coming off of frothy markets, I think the SEC recognizes that that is one thing to look for in terms of capital deployment. And I think historically those were called quote-unquote good GP-led transactions, although they also have a conflict of interest associated with it. So now we're just coming off of these frothy markets, and these quote-unquote good GP-led transactions are just starting to kind of mature. And so I wouldn't be surprised to see the SEC exam staff focusing on those as opposed to kind of the first variety, which will happen again. They just are not mature enough for the SEC to start looking at them now.
The private fund advisors rules under the Investment Advisors Act of 1940 have been designed explicitly with the best interest of investors in mind. More broadly, the LP view on GP-led continuation funds remains somewhat mixed, Disha said.
And even in terms of whether people wish they didn't exist to whether they're affirmatively coming in and actively participating as buyers in these deals, you know, different institutions are, you know, taking polar opposite paths on that. And I think there is consensus, you know, around some core concepts. You know, if you don't want to find yourself moving from fund one to the continuation fund or being forced into a continuation fund and suddenly having worse economics. So there can be some basic principles that people agree upon. Likewise, you know, with respect to what happens to limited partners co-invest positions when an asset, you know, is part of a GP-led transaction. But there is still a very mixed view, and that's really institution by institution in terms of do they want to be participating in these deals, how and when. And some of that reflects, you know, experience with particular transactions and whether they feel, you know, the transactions were sold across on terms that perhaps weren't fair, you know, from a pricing perspective to the existing fund. Some of that's internal procedural things. You know, if institutionally you can't react quickly enough to ever be able to elect anything other than cashing out, that may color your view of the transactions as compared to an institution that has the ability to participate on the buy side. And so while I think that there is a view that on some core concepts, you know, disclosure is good, giving people time to be able to evaluate the opportunity is good, I don't think there's consensus in terms of whether, you know, people wish the transactions would go away or not, or, you know, on particular terms. And I think the reality is, and I think most of the limited partners acknowledge this, these deals are here to stay. And then, you know, individual institutions, you know, are in the position of navigating how they'd like to react to them as they come into their portfolios.
Rosenblit and Disha do not believe these regulations herald the biggest change in the secondaries industry over the last 10 years, but
I think what they do is they raise the visibility of GP-led transactions to LPs, and they signal how important and risky those transactions might be. What the knock-on effects of those rules will be, I'm not totally sure, but I wouldn't be surprised for LPs who have already focused on these transactions to focus on them even more, because while all the other risks that the LPs have always worried about are present, now you've got an additional regulatory risk as an LP that you have to worry about, and LPs are typically very concerned with their exposure to headline risk.
So how can the secondaries buyers and the markets advisors best ensure that they're operating within best practice guidelines, while the fiduciary duty ultimately falls on the GP undertaking these GP-led transactions? There is a reputational risk for both buyers and advisors, both Disha and Rosenblit explained.
And that is not solely around regulatory reputational risk, but, you know, even who are they affiliating with as they do deals. And individual deals have their own parameters. And is it a reinvest? Is it a roll? Quite how are the terms structured? That there's a great deal of variability in terms of what the contours of particular transactions end up being negotiated to. But most of the secondary buyers are fairly cognizant of trying to make sure that they're navigating a transaction in a way that, you know, makes sense and that is not going to draw, you know, too much scrutiny. And so, you know, ILPA, for example, has its, you know, recommendations with respect to GP-led transactions. Individual transactions may not check every single box within those ILPA guidelines, and there could be good reasons why they don't. But both on the secondary buyer side and, you know, candidly on the fund side, you know, looking at doing these GP-leds, people are well aware of what those guidelines are and are thoughtful about when and how they may deviate from them, which I think has added a bit of a discipline of its own, independent of the regulatory requirement. And, you know, candidly, there's also the enforcement mechanism of the limited partners themselves and a bit of concern on the part of both the fund sponsors and the secondary buyers that if you're too far out of bounds in what you're doing, that could, you know, candidly influence your ability to raise capital in the future.
My experience as kind of a third-party observer is that selling LPs are fairly forgiving in kind of reading about conflicts of interest, internalizing them, and accepting them. And so it seems like it's a much higher risk not to disclose some of these issues than to disclose them. But again, I think that others who have been doing many transactions over a period of time probably know best. But I would expect the focus on these kinds of transactions to be elevated, at least in the current market environment. And I would say probably as long as there is a Democratic chair of the SEC.
As for the question of whether or not there may be more regulation on the horizon for the GP-led secondaries market,
I don't think so. And I think that the SEC has sufficient tools now to pursue the kind of conduct that they want in the GP-led market. The big issue the SEC has always had with GP-leds is that they just don't know when they're happening. And because they don't know when they're happening, they can't really pursue them. And they try to solve that with this Form PF rule that I described earlier. But now that the SEC has visibility into those transactions, a year, two, or three from now, the SEC will have a decent database of transactions that have taken place. And they'll be able to combine that information with market information and other information they get from other agencies or other investors to start examining the highest risk GP-led transactions. To me, that's the biggest risk for GPs who want to engage in some of those more risky situations.
And what about regulation targeting the LP-led side of the market?
I mean, that's a good question. It's a good, maybe like philosophical or metaphysical question. But the SEC, I think, views LPs as the investors they are protecting, even though many LPs are also investment managers in their own right. And so a lot of the focus has been, and I would imagine would continue to be, on the GP side.
That again was Igor Rosenblit and Isabel Disha. In our next episode, we'll take a look into the birth of programmatic secondary sales.
PJT completed some research late last year that looked back at the last 10 years of selling activity in the LP market. And we found that of the just under $500 billion of activity that was completed in the LP market over the last 10 years, 50% of that activity, so think $225 to $250 billion of activity, was executed by 50 sellers coming back and repeating the same activity and being, you know, to use the intention, more intentional with each successive sale, and also the frequency increased over that time period. What we've seen in the last 2 years is an enormous expansion of the number of first-time sellers that have come forward.
That's Adrian Milan, a partner at PJT Park Hill, talking about the LP-led secondaries market's driving force over the past decade, its repeat LP sellers. As more investors look to sell into the secondaries market, given the liquidity crunch seen over the last couple of years, how large could the LP-led secondaries market grow to? More on that on the next episode of the Decade of Secondaries Investor miniseries. The production editor on this miniseries was Evie Russman, and our audio editor is Eric Fish. For links to the several articles we mentioned from Secondaries Investor in this episode, be sure to check out the description or head straight to secondariesinvestor.com. I'm Madeline Farman. Thanks for listening.